crossing the Western threshold. This is the theme of Lime and I's podcast as we're trucking across the Rockies and really diving into. And it was interesting trying to sort of podcast on the road and accumulate all of our experiences over the course of the trip out and trip back from the national show. But there was a monumental thing that happened when we crossed the Rockies. Obviously, we get to engage with the Denver boys, and that community of individuals is really pushing the level. But that division of East and West that the Rocky Mountains form as a backbone of the country sort of catalyzed this conversation between Lime and I and the truck that that seemed warranted and worthy of sharing. So there might be some ridiculousness in here. There's definitely references to the Wild West as we romanticize it to be. But it was truly a pleasure to enjoy the ride with Lime, and the thoughts that we shared, we're excited to hand over to you guys. So don't judge, enjoy.
So there's a great coffee shop in Twin Falls with baristas that have dreadlocks and 150 foot deep canyon that people base jump off of the bridge into.
So you're saying their coffee shop is comparable to our coffee shops?
I think that's aggressive. I think that's aggressive, because one thing about driving across the country that you recognize is how damn good Portland coffee is.
It is absolutely spoiled.
Legitimately the best. Oh, it's the best.
So spoiled.
I did enjoy my watered down Folgers with artificially flavored creamer at Todd's this morning, though.
I think we were deprived of coffee.
It was amazing.
Four cups of coffee later. I'm finally moving normal.
4 cups of coffee later, I felt like I feel at Mariah with half a cup of espresso.
Right, and then you went to the garden and had a good old time with Todd out there.
yeah. Driving across the country, I don't know that I would say I could be a trucker, but I wouldn't put it past me. If Boneside doesn't work out, trucking could be my next career move.
Can I ask you please not to?
That's not ideal situation, but that is, I'm just saying there's a backup now.
I don't know, that landscape design stuff. You got that.
Yeah, too. I feel like landscape design would be exactly like Boneside. Scratching and clawing to make a living. It's all good if you love it.
Yeah.
Sacrifice you make to do something you love. What are your impressions on this trip back across the country? Anything stick out to you? I mean, you've done this before quite a bit. I've done it quite a bit. Each trip has a different nuance. This one definitely has been a unique one for me.
One of the most, I mean, so we're pretty stressed. We got to get home. We have time frames. We got to be places, but yet I'm also extremely relaxed for the first time.
Really?
I'm not really angry or frustrated or stressed out. Usually when I'm driving across the country, I have a tremendous amount of stress riding on me, and I am not comfortable, and when I'm stopping places, and, you know, stopping in Colorado yesterday and taking a break and seeing Adam's house, Will's house, Todd's house, and just giving all those hugs and just being there halfway in between the left and the right coast was quite an experience. I really feel rejuvenated and really happy that we have such a wonderful Boneside community.
Colorado's got something special going on, doesn't it?
Next level, man. Oh, my God. Those guys got some trees. I can't even believe it. I mean, wow. It was like a present just showing up there. I was like, oh my goodness, this is incredible, guys.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah, people have no idea. People don't know yet.
I didn't. I mean, they told me that they were doing stuff, but I had no idea that it was that good. I mean, wow. Wow.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It's always cool. It's really rewarding. That snapshot that I was able to take in Adam's workshop of that tree on the backdrop all lit up, because we rolled into his house and it was pitch black dark to load up trees, but it was so fitting to get to stop there. And you know, Todd had just gotten home from the national show. He was totally thrashed from the drive. We're basically limping into his
I was literally limping.
Yeah, you were. I felt so mentally fatigued. It was crazy. But seeing the lights on when we rolled out there and Adam was working in his workshop and stuff, it was pretty cool, man.
I like the fact that we went to the porch, we saw a flashlight laying on the table, we immediately jumped up and went out and started looking at all the trees.
Yeah. The bonsai infection is strong.
Oh, that
the
bristlecone
pine. The force is strong.
Or yeah, that bristlecone.
Yeah.
That was strong.
Yeah. I think it just... It sort of hit me all at once when we rolled into his place, and it's like, oh man, this is really seeing how much Adam's grown and seeing Will's trees and the kind of work he's doing, and obviously Todd has become a superstar, you know, in the United States and even in Europe. I mean, had a great showing in Europe and is going to be continuing to work in Europe. It's like, it's very as a professional, obviously, having worked in Japan, the path is very clear to me to how you become good at bonsai. You work on good trees with a good instructor, and then you go home and you put the pedal to the metal, right? But kind of rolling into Adam's house and seeing everything illuminated, and he was kind of grinding in his workshop waiting for us and stuff, it sort of encapsulated the kind of quality and growth that you're seeing in that crew of guys out there, where they're just putting in the time. They're putting in the time in a big way. And I think the national show sort of highlighted that there's a lot of people across the country putting in the time. And I don't know. I mean, you could never say to this date that people haven't been putting in the time, because obviously they have. There's a monumental foundation that's been built for bonsai to grow and improve on. But it's really neat to see the next iteration and the younger generation, as well as the continuation of, you know, the generations that have paved the foundation for us, keep pushing and really keep sort of working hard. That's been a big reflection of driving back from the national show. It's just that a lot of people are putting in a lot of time, a lot of really quality time, really a lot of really dedicated time.
I also, you know, I know I wasn't around 40 years ago, but 50 years ago, but looking at the material that these guys are collecting, and I hang out at Randy's place a lot, and I'm looking at material Randy pulls, and I walked through their yards, and the material that these guys have sitting at their fingertips waiting to be worked, learning, and some of the stuff that Adam told me, you know, sitting on a tree for 9 years waiting for that moment to execute. I mean, I was just blown away. It was extremely motivating and encouraging to keep the nose of the grinding wheel, push hard, and wow, the material now has to be better than anything ever before.
Yeah. I mean, yeah, I would say there's a strong possibility of that. I mean, and it's not better than anything that there ever was before. It's just the fact that the material's it's ready now.
Quantity is
there's a lot of good material. Randy's in like his 17th year of collecting or something like that.
17th or 18th.
Yeah.
19th year or something like that.
So I mean, he's been doing it for a while. He's really inspired a large generation. I mean, Dan Robinson, obviously. And even before him, you know, Harry Harrow and that whole crew, Jerry Morris. I mean, we get back into that sort of spiral of all of the people that have kicked it off.
I feel like we're ready to, seeing the quantity of material and the excitement, I feel like we're almost ready for the explosion of bonsai in the country right now. I felt like, oh man, these guys could really take the torch and help sustain them, plus probably another couple hundred people doing, you know, but sustain the growth that we need to really make the art form, I don't know, blow up, I guess.
Yeah, it's
more accessible.
It's interesting when you start thinking about what does it look like for bonsai to evolve and grow, because the material that's out there is a finite resource, right?
It is, yes, for sure.
And so if bonsai explodes and grows, learning on the best material, and then all of a sudden, you know, everybody's blades are sharp and the best has already been worked, you've got sort of the leftovers for the real skill to be applied to it. It starts to be a precarious situation. But I think bonsai's already started exploding, and I think what you're seeing in that material, having sat there, is you've seen the process of waiting for the skills to evolve to be able to work the material in a really responsible way so that it maximizes and does justice to that level. And it's cool now to see that level rising to the degree that that material can actually have justice done to it.
I like how you said that.
Because when you know, if you go back to even looking at the best California junipers that were collected out of the Mojave, you don't really see that highest level of California juniper around much anymore, you know, and the skills and the knowledge had to be built on the best material. And now, not to say that the material is bad, but you better believe when they first entered Jawbone that the material they were finding that in that untouched ground was really pretty spectacular and special. So there's a balance there. I think the material pushes the practitioner to be better just as much as an instructor does. I think it's a duality. You've got to have the guidance as well as you've got to have the call to raise your level in order to really hit that next phase or that next echelon of bone size skill, and we're there. Clearly we're there.
I agree with that. You know, there's several trees, as you've seen, I've brought them up to the nursery. I've been nervous to work on things too because I'm afraid that my level isn't ready for it, and I've made mistakes. I've killed some branches in styling. I've made some things, and I've collected these trees. I've kept them alive. I've done so good, and I don't want to lose them, and I'm scared to work on them. I'm literally like stricken with fear, like my skill's not there. If I screw this up, I don't have this piece of material. I don't have that moment in my life again. And I think I have waited on some stuff. I have now some of my stuff 3 years out of collection, still sitting in the yard waiting, but I'm okay.
Keep building your skills, and the time will come. I mean, if Adam's waiting 9 years to work on a tree, you know, that tree just gets stronger and stronger.
Healthier and healthier, ready to go.
Yeah. I'm really excited to see what happens with his big bristle cone. That'll be one of the most powerful bristle cone pines that exists.
I will definitely be there drooling the whole time that's done.
Yeah. Yeah, that's going to be that's coming up. It's exciting that it's in the truck, and Will's fur is going to be amazing too. But I think, you know, like when I was in college, I was collecting a lot, and I was good at collecting, and I had a good survival rate, but I didn't know anything about working on material of that level because I just didn't have the guidance. It was cool to launch the live vein cleaning and handling stream this week, and also the deadwood stream is going to follow, so that process, that really clear delineated process of the work that goes into taking a Yamadori juniper and starting to do all of the work to groom it to be an abstracted rendition of what a natural juniper would be, you know, in the bonsai form. That, honestly, that stream was one of the biggest questions that I had in college. Like, how do you handle the live vein? How much do you take off? Is it okay? Is it safe? How do I know when I've gone too far? How do you create this deadwood? And what do you do with it? You know, and it seems really rudimentary and very, very simple and very basic, but it's really not. It's a very complex situation. There's very few junipers at Mirai that I go in and clean, or Troy goes in and clean and do the live vein work on, where there's not still some areas where there's a lot of question and discomfort or uncertainty around where has the live vein receded to. You know, is it still in process, or is it actually something where we're just not going far enough? And getting to do that stream and see that grafted Rocky Mountain through to its completion, I was really pumped for that stream to come out.
That's really important information. That was one of the first things you ever taught me, actually. You and Troy, you sat me down up there at Mirai and threw a tree in front of me, had me cleaning live vein, cleaning up the wood, and showed me the bores and everything. I immediately went home for the next 3-4 days maybe and cleaned a bunch of junipers that I had collected, and I ended up getting a bunch of bores out of them.
Yep.
And I was like, whoa, I probably just saved that tree's life.
Yeah.
You know, and then we had our fall show at BSOP. Mm-hmm. I think this was 3 years ago. We did the fall show, and I brought a juniper in and was like, well, I mean, this is the thing that Ryan taught me. I guess I'll sit here and I'll work on this as something for people to ask questions about. And multiple people walked up to him and go, I've been doing bonsai 15 years and I've never seen anyone do this in my life.
That's what I'm saying.
15. I'm like, really? How are you so new? Why are you? What is this? I was like, the first thing you've shown me. This is so important. And it was cool to hear people get so excited about watching something so...
It's basic. It's fun. Basic. It's a fundamental step that nobody, I think, because it's fundamental, nobody wants to ask, or it's often glazed over because we jump right into the styling process. But it's really necessary to have that step done to be able to make really good quality design decisions. And yeah, I had that. I mean, I remember traveling down to LA and up to San Francisco and in college, just trying to get, how do you apply raffia? How do you clean a live vein? How do you handle deadwood correctly? And it was really tough to get those answers. And then going to Japan, that too was the very, you know, outside of watering and cleaning needles off of a juniper, in the first day of my apprenticeship, Mr. Kimura showed me how to clean sort of the bottom growing needles off of a white pine to make it look nicer. And then he gave me a Shimbaku juniper to clean the live vein on and delineate the live vein from the deadwood. I didn't have a clue what I was doing. I had no clue what I was doing, and I also didn't understand Japanese at that point, and all of the other apprentices were out of the garden. So there was no, I had no possibility of being able to communicate with him about it. I was like sweating.
That had to be nerve-wracking.
It was horrible.
Oh my God.
It was horrible. And he was looking at me like, this guy is so green and clueless. I even remember him saying as he walked away, like, this guy's not gonna make the cut. Like, my first day didn't go well at Mr. Kimura's, but that's okay. That was the first of many days that didn't go well. But that skill is a backbone, and we're using more and more junipers, and we're seeing more and more opportunity for these fundamentals to be in place, and the necessity for them to be in place to be able to do this work well. And so passing on those skills and that knowledge and know-how increases your confidence. Now you don't have to worry about that. You can handle that situation with confidence and with knowledge, and it just allows you to open the next door of technique. So I was pumped on that stream. I was really stoked. Jesus did a great job with it, and it's been an incredible trip. Here's the other thing about driving across the country this time that I've really experienced is there's living in a very populated area of the United States, like Portland or the Pacific Northwest, and then, you know, driving through the populations. It's such a contrast driving through the populations and the populated cities, and then the vast amount of wide open space that exists throughout the United States and North America is shocking. It's shocking.
It shrinks you down. Sometimes I sit there and think, and I like when I'm looking out the window and I'm not driving, putting myself way up in the mountain. What would it be like if there was no roads here? Where would I be? Who would be around? Nothing would be here. I always imagine myself. It's this little imaginary game I always play, climbing around the mountains and nothing. Man, it would take me months to get somewhere where civilization was, you know?
Yeah, you said that when we were driving through Colorado today.
I did.
Just like, I wonder what this was like when everybody was on horses.
That was what was going through my head.
Not like this. That's what I was thinking. As we were watching a forest fire literally obliterate some quality collecting grounds, that was, as you know, the harsh reality of the environments that create these wonderful pieces of material is that any day they can go up in smoke or drought or insects. They're at the mercy of the natural environment. I guess we all kind of are. We've kind of created this bubble for ourselves with houses, cities, refrigeration,
concrete jungles,
heat, air conditioning,
yeah,
water being delivered at will. Yeah, it's really interesting. Almost running out of gas several times as we're looking for gas stations crossing, which would be the
52 gallon tank.
Which would be 56 to be exact, on a ginormous truck, which means we stopped for gas way too much. And to pull into a truck stop and fill a large truck up with gas is not a rapid, quick thing.
No.
Every single gas stop takes us like 40 minutes.
And we got to get fuel, go to the bathroom. It's also the time to stretch the legs. Like, yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, it's not as easy as pulling up and putting your credit card in the pump when you're in a big truck. I do gain a tremendous amount of respect for all of the goods that are moved throughout the country via semis driving across the country like this. I mean, as we're driving several times on this trip, we've been one of many semis in a line of only semis on the road when everybody else is asleep and going nowhere. And yet again...
Like right now.
Yet again, driving across Idaho at almost 10 o'clock at night, there are no cars. It's just us with all of the other semis. It's like a brotherhood of truckers.
Yeah, and without them, we'd have nothing. We'd have
no
goods,
we need a CB next time.
Oh, man, I was thinking about that.
I knew you wanted that. You want, because you keep waving to every trucker that
I
wonder what they think about that. Like, who's
They're usually waving at me, too.
Are they really?
Yeah, we make eye contact and always wave.
Well, you're always looking at them. You're kind of glaring at them through the window, and you're, like, looking at them, watching and waiting until they look at you, and then you give them a nice little, like... friendly wave.
I'm just trying to be friendly, you know. Hey, we're all on the road together, let's be nice.
I'm not kidding though, at the last truck stop, when that truck came rolling through the gas station that quick and you were standing there and that guy got out, he looked at you like, I'm gonna kick your ass. When I walked up to you and I was like, Lime, what are you doing?
He was gonna run me over, and the crazy dude come rushing through the gas pumps. Like, you don't come rushing through the gas pumps. We're all pumping fuel there. Slow down, dude.
He was trying to cut down on that 40-minute stop, and you were definitely in the way, and he didn't like it.
No, he did not. I was not stoked on that either.
And as you were in there using the bathroom, he was just staring at me. He was just giving me the
weird,
just the stink eye. I was in the truck, and I could tell that you had clearly upset him by your conduct, and you had violated the brotherhood pledge.
I think. Any other trucker probably would have said something to him and then like, hey, dude, what are you doing? We're all here trying to pump fuel.
I don't know.
Slow the hell down.
Dude. I don't know that. I don't really see them. I think that they're more comfortable on the CB.
Oh, maybe.
They are in person, because they don't. Nobody's really talked to us. Of course, we don't have a legitimate truck, which I do feel a little insecurity around not driving a true semi. I feel like that may be the next step. Need a sleeper cab. Need a big semi. And
really
definitely, I need to work on my call sign. What did you say your call sign was?
Oh my goodness! Oh, we did this.
I thought you gave it to me last time. What's your call sign?
I gave your call sign was Blue Steel.
That's right. Okay, I'm in. Blue Steel. That's right. It's my adult film. It's my adult film.
Slash trucker
well.
Life.
Yeah, cool.
Slash right. trucker life.
I'm in there. L.A. Here we come. Yeah, the expansive amount of space freaks me out. Totally freaks me out. I think differently about free-range cattle, because living in Portland, all of the conversations are about why veganism is the way to go. No shame on veganism. Stopped at several vegan restaurants on the way out to New York. All about it. It's great. I'm driving back with you. It's been a little bit more of a carnivore fest.
Am I more carnivorous?
Yeah,
human being.
Definitely sampling barbecue across the country as we're rolling hard towards Mirai. Very enjoyable at that.
Ribs and ripping meat.
Yeah, but there is a lot of space, a lot of unused space. Wyoming is the most shocking of all. I don't know. Wyoming had a big impact on me.
It is. Every time I've gone through it, it's all I see is just open space and all these antelope running around and this wildlife. You always see wildlife in Wyoming.
Yeah.
You know, it's like, man, oh man. You know, and why not let the cattle be out there, you know? Keep the grass down, keep things at bay. Like, to me, it just seems reasonable.
Yeah. Yeah, know? Maybe. I definitely felt fairly threatened by the strength of wind today. It's the first time I've ever put the pedal to the metal and the truck could not overcome the strength of the wind. I mean, not even with a hill. It was just straight up. I was trying to go 70 miles an hour and the truck could only go 60 because the wind was so strong.
That was interesting. That was a unique experience. I mean, I've definitely had big wins in all of my drives across the country, coming from Florida up to Mirai through the southern route of the United States, driving through Joshua Tree. There were several semis that actually blew over, and I was in a Penske that was far lighter than this thing, and that was really scary. That was probably the closest I've actually ever physically come to tipping over. And I was driving through Sacramento over one of the bridges that crossed the San Joaquin River Delta, and a semi actually blew off of the bridge, like physically off of the bridge.
Oh my gosh.
When I was driving over, I didn't see the semi fall. I saw the aftermath of it, and then I definitely felt like my truck was going to be next. But today it was intimidating just because the truck physically couldn't keep up with the wind.
Well, most every truck that came around us was leaning.
It was slanted.
Right.
It was slanted on the highway. It was
every
crazy.
Truck.
Yeah.
There was not one truck not leaning.
It really reinforced the point why Wyoming is the least populated state in the country.
Oh, dude, the winters there. Oh my! I've been through the winter there a few times. Tried to drive through a bad winter storm, and that was the stupidest thing. Yo, so dumb. That wind gets picking up, and the snow comes flying at you so fast, you can't see anything. You know.
I don't even think it's isolated to the winter. I think the wind is just this consistent year-round thing that you have to become very used to. I remember being in Japan as an apprentice, trying to sweep up Mr. Kimura's gardens in the morning, and on windy days, there was nothing more frustrating than wind, because you'd like clean up this nice little patch, and you'd feel like you could move on, and then the wind would come and blow all the leaves back onto it, and you would start again, and you knew
it's all over.
You knew if you didn't do it, if it wasn't cleaned up when Mr. Kimura came out, he was going to be upset. So spend like several hours sweeping up freaking leaves on a windy day, it started to feel pretty pointless. It's the only time I've really ever felt super frustrated at nature. Yeah, at nature. Just like, gosh darn it.
You're making my work.
Stop blowing.
Stop. I'm trying to finish.
I did feel a little bit like that today. It was hard to get through Wyoming.
I'm trying to get home.
It was hard to get through Wyoming today. Yeah. But, you know, that wind gives a lot of character to the trees that exist there. So you can't really be that mad.
We have a low pressure setting in our country. And if you go up in that part of the country, Wyoming, Montana, South Dakota, North Dakota, there's this headwind that goes opposite from like the west to the east. It follows the low pressure setting because low pressures go clockwise. And the wind, as the further you get up, gets more and more. I mean, we probably had, I would say, 25, 30 knot winds, 30 knot winds. As you go up, it gets up to 100 knot winds.
Nobody knows what the hell a knot is.
Okay. It's a speed they use on a ship. There are tons of people that sail boats that know what a knot is.
I know, but can we speak in miles per hour? We had 50, 60 mile an hour winds today.
Yeah, 40. I'd say 40 mile an hour winds.
It said 50. 40 plus, and there were definitely some stronger winds, I can
maybe
tell
it's
you
50,
that.
60, yeah.
Yeah.
So, but as you go up, that means if we're hitting 50, 60 miles an hour, that means up in the air is probably 150 to 180 miles an hour.
Well, it's great to see as we were driving along the Rockies north of Denver to get up to Wyoming, and we're just basically paralleling the Rockies, to see that backbone of the country.
Oh, it's great.
And the significance of the Rockies, because obviously it's the Continental Divide. The rivers on the east flow to the Gulf of Mexico. The rivers on the west, they flow to the Pacific Ocean. So it really creates that. And Kendall wrote a blog post about the Rocky Mountains. If you guys haven't read it, you should check it out, because it's beautifully written, and there's also a lot of factual information about how significant the Rocky Mountains are in terms of the not only the topography and the geography of our country, but also just as a symbol or a representation of almost a divide of culture in a way. You know, that westward expansion, that westward exploration, the Rocky Mountains were really sort of that stair step, I think, as she called it, a stair step to the west, where you had to get through those to get to that next promised land and that next land of expansion and stuff. Driving along it, where that air comes up from the Gulf of Mexico and hits the east side of the Rockies, and the jet stream is coming from the Pacific Ocean, and it's dropping a lot of moisture over the top of the Rockies, and then it's slamming into that that air from the Gulf of Mexico creates the wind and the dynamic that you experience in Wyoming, and creates a lot of the weather that they experience through the southeastern portion of the country and the central portion of the country, where you see a lot of tornado activity and just a lot of gnarly weather. And it's all being driven by these bodies of water creating this weather that basically pounds this mountain range that splits the United States like a butt crack.
Well, one of the things we were talking about at Todd's house is how this is like the only place you can stand around and see clouds going in any given direction.
Yeah.
All at once. And my all of my experiences in Colorado and the Rockies is, yeah, I may say it's clear skies, but you never know. At any given moment, something could pop up and bam, you have an isolated storm with lightning.
Yeah, last night it was clear at Todd's house and it looked like there was a tornado over Adam's house.
Yeah. And then we had a little bit of rain, you know, a little drizzle here there and scattered.
Saw some lightning.
Saw a lot of light. Yeah, a bunch of lightning. That was cool.
Yeah.
You know?
And lo and behold, there was a forest fire this morning with slurry bombers and a helicopter dropping water on it. Yeah, you get it all. It was tough to leave Colorado. I haven't, if I'm just being really honest, I haven't missed Colorado that much in my life. There have been periods where I've missed Colorado. Growing up there, I got my fill of the Rockies. And the main thing that was really difficult to deal with in Colorado was the dryness.
Yeah.
Because it is very, very dry. You depend on that moisture from the Pacific Ocean holding on over the Sierras, over the Cascades, until it gets to the Rocky Mountains. And you've got this desert, this massive rain shadow east of the Sierras, which is marked where the bristlecones are growing, east of the Sierras in the rain shadow. Death Valley is there. You get through Nevada and that entire desert. You go through Utah and that entire desert, and then it starts stepping up. And I grew up in the foothills on the western slope of the Rocky Mountains. And I felt very lucky if we got significant moisture. Usually in the wintertime, we would get significant snow. But when I was a kid, we went through like a 10-year drought and had several winters where we virtually got no snow. And
I
so,
I remember those years.
Yeah. So Colorado to me was just dry. I mean, the oaks would go prematurely into dormancy because there wasn't any moisture, and the aspens have been sort of climbing up in terms of where they're capable of surviving in the mountains as things warm up a little bit and moisture patterns change. But being there this time, Denver has a liveliness about it, a lot like Portland does. It's becoming another one of those. It's a cool place to be. It's a hip place to be. It's experienced massive expansion. There's a lot of room in the plains east of the Rocky Mountains. But I think there's also a lot of cultural things happening there that are super interesting on a national level that make it a real hub and sort of a desirable place to be. And you could feel that energy a lot like you could feel the energy at the national show for the Boneside community. You could almost feel that energy of this place of opportunity in Denver. It was really exciting to be there.
Yeah, I haven't been back. And last time I was in Denver, I was at Red Rocks. It was 2013, I believe it was. I was at a Soundtribe show. That's the last time I was in Denver. So it's been a while for me. And I usually frequent that area. So, I lived in Fort Collins and Loveland for a little bit. So
yeah, I've never been to Red Rocks.
Oh, so beautiful.
I know.
That photo. You saw that photo.
I did.
Oh, my goodness.
I did. I feel ashamed of that. I've tried. I've tried to go to Red Rocks a couple
times.
We'll
fix that.
Hasn't worked out.
We'll fix that.
We'll get there.
Yep.
We'll get there. But even talking to Todd today, and Todd's like, yeah, got one day before I'm going to be, you know, going to work with another group again. Maybe I'll go into the mountains and collect a few trees.
So
maybe I'll work in my backyard. I was just, I was like, maybe we'll stay another day and join you in the mountains.
I was so jealous when he said that, dude.
Man, yeah. Yeah.
Todd, it's that close for you. Oh,
it is.
That's man.
Part of the fruits of living in Colorado. And they've got a great bonsai community to facilitate that, the utilization of that material and the growth, which is super cool.
Yeah, listening to Adam and Todd talk, it was very interesting how they're holding on to parts for the club and doing stuff. I was like, oh, yeah, we all do the same thing, huh?
It's universal.
It's universal. I got a bunch of stuff stored at my house for the club.
Love for the club. Yeah, we're racing home to get home for the 2018 Bonsai Society of Portland rendezvous this coming weekend. Lyme and I both are going to try to get enough sleep to be there and be able to construct coherent sentences. I don't know how it's going to go because we're currently we're in the middle of Idaho and it is 10 p.m. and the navigation system says we will arrive in Portland at 5 a.m. on Thursday and I'll be working at 8 a.m. on Friday. So we'll see how this goes.
This is gonna be fun.
Yeah, this could be fun. But I really find a lot of beauty in Utah, and that's something. It's like all of the landscapes across North America are interesting for their own reasons. Nebraska and Iowa and the cornfields, the sun setting out there, the quality of the bugs that were splattering on our window seem to be better through Nebraska and Iowa. I mean, big, fat, juicy
Huge bugs.
Nothing small, no little just like scuffs on the windshield. It's blinding splats of like technicolored windshield.
Yeah, we did.
We even got out one time and there were a few very large, abnormally large. I'm guessing these are GMO praying mantis.
They were stuck
to the grill of our truck that were colors I've never seen.
We had a nice one stuck to the windshield blade.
Do we?
It was stuck up under there for a while.
Yeah. Yeah, big bugs. They grow big bugs and lots of corn.
But
the sunset that we caught in Nebraska was outstanding.
Was outstanding. To piggyback off the Utah thing, I passed through Utah I don't know how many times. I didn't appreciate Utah until I went to southern Utah. And I went through these back rural roads through Utah. I don't know why I was there or what I was doing. I was like, I've always been through Salt Lake City. I've never been down here.
Mm.
You know, it was just
like
blank.
Bryce Canyon and
yes.
or
yeah, Bryce
Moab
Canyon,
and Arches
Moab
and all that stuff.
I didn't
yeah.
actually go to the parks. I avoided the parks. I wanted to stay away from people for whatever reason that time. But I just the color of the rock, the rolling hills, the trees. It was just I was really blown away. Maybe it's mid Utah area.
Well, and as we approached Utah from Wyoming and we got into the canyons that kind of delineate the border of Wyoming and Utah outside of Ogden, the changing of the colors, you realize that it's September 12th today.
Yeah, that
it's September 12th and the colors were full on reds, oranges and yellows.
Yep.
Full on the aspens in Colorado.
That was so beautiful.
Even as low as just above the elevation in Denver, the aspens were already turning yellow. It's September 12th.
Yeah.
That's crazy.
I've never been so excited for fall in my entire life like this year.
Yeah. Fall. I think fall is going to come on really early, and I don't know what that looks like for winter, but we don't get that huge color change. And it's not nearly as dramatic in the Pacific Northwest.
No, totally not.
And the changing of the colors across a majority of the country is a massive part of seasonal delineation that we really kind of miss out on.
Yeah.
It was cool to see that today. It was really beautiful. There were a lot of really beautiful rivers and rock formations and stuff that we got to see that haven't looked that beautiful in other trips across the country.
The colors changing was the reds, we got the yellows, the oranges that were up there. Oh, with the green in the background, the darker green, the lighter greens.
Yeah.
It was just like a beautiful, you know, Bob Ross painting.
It was a Bob Ross moment, and yeah. Like, you know, to sit and pontificate on all of these little details is to say, every time I go across the country, there is a different experience. Each time, though, there's one continuous thread, and that is North America is freaking awesome. It's massive.
Gorgeous.
It's still very wild. As much as I think we try to downplay the loss of the wildness, or we mourn the loss of the wildness or open spaces, you recognize that there is still a lot of open space and a lot of uncharted territory, or at least minimally impacted territory in North America has a lot of room and ground to inspire. I mean, even the blowing grass and the tones and the tints of the evaporating water that was leaving behind salt and the specific grasses that were growing in that heavily salineated soil throughout Wyoming and Utah was breathtaking. I mean, tones of red and ruby and purple and yellow and green and mint. It was really dramatic.
There's so much open space. You think about, you know, well, here's it. What happens if we did break down out there? You know what I mean? There was points where the difficulty of trying to get help or getting someone to us would have been very, very stressful.
Yeah. I mean, we do have cell phones now, so that would have But it would have been several hours for AAA to get to us.
Yeah, or I mean, or, you know, you take someone out to one of these mountains here. This, just go a couple miles off the freeway here, and there's no one. There's going to be nothing out there.
Yeah.
You leave someone there, they could die.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah, that's true.
This is very wild, wild country. You have to come out here with a deep respect for nature and be prepared at any moment for what nature could do to you.
I mean, I think seeing it again, I have this idea rolling around in my head of space, just the necessity for space and Bonesai. We talked about it on the last podcast. We talked about it in reference to how we conduct exhibitions, and it's been ever since the Artisans Cup where space was still an issue. Thinking about an exhibition that isn't limited by space. And when you start to talk about that thematic as it relates to North America, it seems just this drive has reinforced that has to be the next frontier that we explore. What is
wow,
it?
What, you just went
what,
there.
What does that look like? I just feel like, wow. I feel like you, like when we start to think about things in a lot more experiential level, that spatial awareness, that if you drive across Europe, you're going to see minimal amounts of space. I mean, I've driven across the UK. I've driven across Belgium and Holland. I've driven across Italy. I've driven across a majority of Spain. Okay. And so seeing all of those places, you have all these little towns scattered throughout sort of the countryside, but the countryside is still very small in between those towns, comparatively speaking, to what we just crossed in North America.
Yeah.
So if we start to touch on those thematics, what is that? How does that interact, and how does that play into the way that we represent our interpretation of nature in miniature, being in this landmass that still does? And we're very lucky. We're very lucky that we have ancient. We're very lucky that we have massive. We're very lucky that we have untouched forests still. We're also very lucky that we have so much space.
Yeah, and, you know, there is a deep appreciation across the spectrum in this country for that wide open space and for the old growth and preserving it. I think that there's a lot of people in this country, most in these rural country communities, it's very important to them to preserve the country.
Yeah. And yeah, I think outside of like commercial interests, the majority of people probably do, whether it's subconscious or it's conscious, do value that.
Yeah,
the uniqueness of that, because it is a landmass that is so gigantic that I guess technically you could occupy all of it, but the resources probably would not be there to sustain people in the most vast areas of the United States. I don't know.
Yeah, I don't think. Yeah, I think we would.
I mean, there's a good reason why a lot of people don't live out in the middle of the windiest parts of Wyoming. That would be. Could you imagine living out there? I mean, what would your house look like after 10 years?
I just couldn't imagine living.
It'd have
there.
To be built out of concrete or something. It's
I think
crazy.
I'd go underground. I'd have my bunker.
Bunker. It'd have to be bunker style. Maybe bunker.
I'd go bunker style.
Maybe bunker style is the new architecture. It's going to be the new trend in
told
architecture.
I told you I want to take over a silo and put it in, have a community down
there.
That'd
be cool. That'd be cool. You go underground, subterranean style.
Yep. Subterranean. Have a whole system set up in there.
I love the thematics that can develop, though, from just experiencing the landscape. You know, it's, I don't, contextually, Bonesai has so much to be explored still. I mean, we've toyed with the species and the styles that we can execute based on our references to the environment or to the Bonesai form, and ceramics is becoming so much more wide open, still valuing the traditional, and I think putting a lot more value, or utilizing more effectively some of this newer, more, I would say, extravagant design in the ceramics. Stands are starting to, in the platform that we present this tree on, having context and contributing to the overall display. Still very, I think that's a very youthful movement right now.
Yeah.
But then the exhibition itself becoming that contextual theme that you can pull on, and that is something that I think is going to become this sort of circular conversation where it really rounds out the ability. Obviously there's the accent piece that has a lot of purpose and that is, it's almost something that can stand on its own and be used in display, but once you start pulling on thematics for the exhibition, it's going to change the way that the trees are taken in by the viewer. And that because we've seen so many exhibitions on the club level and on the national level executed in the same way, and it's a very obviously a very time-tested, valuable way to experience those trees, but there's also other ways, and those other ways are I have an affinity to think about that, just because it can connect people to the trees in ways they haven't been able to see them before. And that the idea of space is that's a big one. That's a vast, it's literally a vast concept of how you can go about conceptually conveying that in an exhibition. But I think that's where I want to focus my efforts.
You know, I haven't driven across the country. I think it's been 9 years now, since 9 years since the last time I drove across the country.
Oh, it's been that long.
It's been that long.
Oh, wow.
From end to end, from like New York to Oregon, or New York to California.
Right.
So getting back and being out here, and now that I'm in the Bonsai, it's been a rejuvenating thing for me.
Mm-hmm.
And I feel very inspired and ready to go home and grab a big old bowl of clay and throw it down and carve up some stuff to remind myself of the trip.
So. Yeah, you said you're going to go home and spend some time in ceramics.
I am. I needed this to kind of give myself some ideas. That my Doug fir, I really want to make the pot for it, and I want to make it represent the environment it came from as best I possibly can.
Hmm.
And I'm struggling with that idea, and I think I might have come up with an idea on this trip, looking at those billowing, beautiful sandstone and limestone that were rolling and pieces coming off and the beautiful texture on it. I think I have something in my head.
I'm excited to see that. I mean, your first run of pots that you did, most people don't know that you, unless they listen to the ceramic stream that you and Troy did, and I was there for only a small portion of it, but most people don't know that you're a really talented ceramicist.
Ben Gliffin knows. He bought a bunch of my pots.
What?
Ben Gliffin, I posted a photo of my first run of pots and was almost PayPaling me money before I could even tell him I don't want to sell them.
Yeah, it was stunning. You got a knack for it. I'll be excited to see what you make. But why go home and dive into ceramics? Why does that seem like the thing that you want
to
do?
I have some trees to work on, and I'm going to work on them, but I got to get the idea out for this. I really want to pot that Doug fir. I've been struggling with design on it for a while, and I feel like I may have something. I'm going to do a couple of scratch designs and see if they're like miniature sizes of them, and see if I scale that up, will that work?
Hmm.
You know, I don't know. I've been looking for inspiration for a while.
Mm-hmm.
And I think I have it. Utah, Wyoming, Colorado, those beautiful reds,
yeah.
Those beautiful whites, the
yeah.
Layering of the colors. Oh man. I just want to see that Doug fir in something pretty. I really like that tree.
It was pretty cool to see Colorado through your eyes this time too. That probably added to.
Well, I didn't grow up there.
Yeah,
Colorado
I really take it for granted. I do take it
yeah,
for granted.
I grew Colorado. You know, growing up in California and Michigan, I always thought of Colorado as this wild west. You know, yeah, like we talked about Billy the Kid and Young Guns, watching all those westerns. Colorado was the Wild West to me. It was this wild, awesome place of creativity and ruggedness, and it was a dreamland for me when I started going there as a kid once in a while.
Yeah.
So every time I go back, I have this, I don't know, I romanticize it a lot.
So Lime, you're throwing out western lore and myths without clarifying it. Lime and I were talking today, and he was telling me how Colorado was reminding him of the Wild West, and I was telling him one of my favorite collecting areas that nobody knows exists because it's in a very, very remote area of Colorado was actually one of the areas that it is widely known as a hideout for Billy the Kid and several of his, what would you call them?
Companions, compañeros.
Okay, all right, yeah. fellow not villains, but not criminals.
Ruffians.
Ruffians. Billy the Kid and his crew, Butch Cassidy and the Sundance Kid used to hang out there as well. Going and collecting trees out there where it's literally, if you don't want to be found out there, nobody's going to find you. Collecting trees out there, probably if you made a wrong step and you died, you might never be found. It's a really interesting
mountain lions would have a nice dinner.
Yeah. No, you would definitely be eaten, if not by mountain lions, by vultures. And they would have to, I don't know, use your teeth or something to figure out who you were. But it's out there. And you recognize back then when it was just so expansive that you could literally just go disappear.
It's so crazy.
Yeah, it is crazy. But the interesting thing is you could still disappear.
Yeah, and also survive out there, too.
Yeah.
You know, think of the high desert, that high area is arid and there's nothing. There's so much life. There's so much life out there.
It's such a contrast to other parts of the country. If you think about Florida and the rate that things grow there and the Pacific Northwest and the rate that things grow there, or the Northeast where we just came from in Rochester. I mean, these are lush, really green, heavily occupied places.
Things are not struggling for survival. Yeah. They're not fighting to survive.
Yeah. Well, I mean, in a different way, maybe.
A different way, yeah.
But I like watching Chef's Table, and one of the chefs in the Chef's Table series on Netflix that I found really inspiring was the gentleman that runs Blue Hills or Blue Stone Farms in New York.
Oh.
Dan something, it'll come to me. Anyways, he created an entire farm around his restaurants to be growing the kind of vegetables that he wanted to use, and then he needed fertilizer, and so they started adding cattle to the environment where they kept the grasses down and their poop naturally fertilized the landscape, and then chickens to spread the poop, and pigs to be doing, I don't know what the pigs were doing, something else, and then goats to hold back and continue to prune back the environment, which he made a statement that the native plants in the forest is always trying to occupy the open space that was created long ago when people first settled and really started to cultivate the land in the Northeast as that first portion of what we know of now as the United States. And I'd never thought about the fact that the native forest is always trying to continually encroach on the open space that was artificially created. That was when he said that, it was just like, you know, my head exploded because I didn't realize that. And at Mirai, I see it all the time. The forest feels like it's constantly growing in and trying to engulf the garden. And it's a real effort to maintain that open space in these landscapes that have the ability to grow so fast and occupy those spaces. And if you weren't there, even 5 years of not keeping the seedlings down that sprout up in the gravel and not pruning the trees back that whose branches reach out and then kind of drop down and start to shade the benches. And I mean, you would be moving back towards a very, very heavily forested environment quickly. And even the gravel that we lay down at Mirai with all of the leaf debris and stuff, and the leaf debris breaks down into organic matter, clogs the gravel, covers the gravel, and all of a sudden where you had gravel and you had an established road and you had an established landscape, you have
a path.
The organic material that creates the forest again.
Grow stuff in.
Yeah, it's crazy. Yeah. It was really interesting to be presented with that idea and to start and to see it firsthand and see it as we're driving across the East Coast. And you see a lot of the consumption. Nature will always reconsume the man-made.
Right. We make these higher state of organization. We create these levels, these straight lines in this organization. And our entropy will just keep taking it back. Unless we want to keep it nice and organized, if we stop organizing it, it'll become chaotic again. You know, our square lines are not how nature works.
Yeah.
Things don't work in square, perfect little lines. They work in however, you know, that plant or that fungal undergrowth wants to move, and we have to keep maintain it. And yeah, that's really I like that perspective.
Yeah. Yeah. Dan Barber. Dan Barber's the name of that chef. Yeah, Dan Barber. Blue Hills. Is it Blue Hills or Bluestone Farms? Anyways.
Yeah, that's like what goes on. Mariah, you're cleaning it up right now. It's getting organized again. And things are constantly being, you know, straightened and done. It's, yeah, it's
or,
cool.
Or organize. You almost need like a professional organizer to be a bonsai to be a bonsai practitioner these days.
The thing I'm not so good at.
Like it's real. It's the organization to being able to run a full scale bonsai garden. I understand more and more why Japan leans so heavily on apprentices. I mean, without apprentices, the scale and scope with which Japanese bonsai has existed for hundreds of years, it just would not have been possible. You really need that. I mean, beyond teaching the next generation to be able to carry on the tradition and carry bonsai forward, you need it just from a physical workforce.
Yeah, I found that with our local community, our BSOP community, that is like I couldn't maintain at home without them. You know, I couldn't be here right now if it wasn't for our community or me. There's a lot of work I do at home on my own garden. I mean, I don't have I don't have a professional garden, it's just my personal. But we have we need a big group of us in order to keep this, you know, at its level.
Yeah.
Am I going in the wrong direction there? I feel like.
Look at just how like vast this space is.
I love it.
People talk about Idaho almost like, yeah, it's potatoes. And then that's usually followed by, and it kind of sucks.
When I think of Idaho is there's several research laboratories up here that I follow and I.
Well, Idaho's amazing. Yeah, that's what I'm saying. When I found Twin Falls,
I'm in love with.
Twin Falls and that massive canyon and just this beautiful town with dreadlock wearing coffee baristas that made a good cup of Joe. It was pretty. I was like, yeah, Idaho. But I think Boise's amazing too. Boise's a real hub of innovation. But Idaho gets such a bad rap because you go into northern Idaho and you've got Coeur d'Alene and all of that beautiful mountainous, really high mountain, high alpine lakes and just an incredibly different environment than southern Idaho. And Boise State always has a good football team that plays on a blue field. So, I mean, when you, like, take all that into account, it's kind of wild.
It is. Yeah. I like going up that border you talk about between Montana and Idaho is really fun to venture around on. I like going on that border and going all through those mountains up there and camping, and the wildlife is intense. If anyone ever goes up there, be very careful. You don't hit a freaking elk or a deer or a bear. There is a lot of wildlife up there. They will come right up to your tent.
I was talking with Oscar tonight. He goes to Eastern Oregon and Eastern Washington kind of to get away from fabricating and stuff and just take a break, and he said that he went out there to bow hunt for elk, and he was within 60 yards of an elk before the elk smelled him and took off. But he said the cooler thing was he was within 30 yards of a black bear.
Oh my goodness. Wow.
While he was out there hunting, and he said it was just really impressive, jet black, beautiful. Wow. Black bear that he didn't even have the heart to draw on, and he just let it do its thing and wander away. That's pretty cool.
So much. This little corridor right here that we're in has so much wildlife and ruggedness. It is still very, very wild, and I believe will always be very, very wild.
Well, and you asked me today if grizzlies were still in Colorado, and from what I've heard, that grizzlies are moving back into Colorado, and that could be debatable, but there have been grizzly sightings in some of the, you know, where we were up as we were leaving Colorado, heading into Wyoming.
That road,
If you head due west, you know, the Medicine Bow Mountains kind of spill not quite down into Colorado, but there's a continuation of the Medicine Bows that kind of blend into the Rockies right there, and that's right where they started seeing the grizzlies.
I wonder if it's Yellowstone has such an like vast population of grizzlies. I wonder if they're coming down from there.
That's what they think.
Oh,
that's exactly what they think is happening.
Because I was up in Montana, and the ranger was giving me, I was getting ready to head out, got my collecting permit and everything, and then she's like, okay, well, this area that you're going to, like, we're having more grizzlies than we've ever had before coming up. And she was telling me, we think...
Where was this?
It was up in northern Montana area, just...
Oh, wow.
Past... what town? I can't think of the name of the town right now, but I was up north of there, and she's telling me that she believe it was... They believe it's coming from Yellowstone. There's so many grizzlies in Yellowstone that they're starting to venture out to try to get more feeding ground.
Well, and the food sources in terms of deer and elk is at an all-time high right now. Or not, maybe not an all-time high, but it is rapidly increasing to the point where if there's a large population of predator in one single area, they'll start to branch out to find more food, and there's a lot of food.
Yeah, it was quite interesting to have that. I mean, I didn't see a grizzly, luckily. I don't ever want to see one, but if I do, I'm sure someday I'll bump into one. But I did see a lot of elk, a lot of mountain goat.
Mm-hmm.
It was incredible up there. It was absolutely incredible.
North America's awesome.
Yeah, I'm deeply in love with Montana.
Yeah?
I'm very in love with Montana.
I'm kind of in love with the whole country. I think there's something in every single place to really be appreciative of. And this has been a process to become very tuned into the beauty of the desert, but it's starting to happen. Arthur always spoke about the desert in a very romanticized way, and I've started to look at the desert differently. Utah really struck me. I think of all the places that we drove through today, Utah was definitely, yeah, the colors.
How can that color not take you?
Yeah, and the sky, just everything about it.
Oh, just the rocks, the colors, yeah.
Yeah.
Well, sorry to all the Montanans if I bring up how much I like it, but you have a beautiful place. I know you want to keep it secret.
Yeah, they're like, shut up.
shut up. Stop talking about our state.
Shh. Nobody needs to know.
It's terrible. It doesn't
exist.
It's
okay. You kind of have to be a badass to go live in Montana anyway, so yeah, that rules out like 90% of people.
Right. It's pretty wide open spaces.
It's a little rugged up there. You got to be a cowboy.
Sky's just a little bit bigger up there.
Yeah.
It's big sky country.
Yeah. Anything else, any other sort of takeaways from this trip across the country, or things that you've experienced over the past week? It's been a big week. It's been a little bit of sensory overload.
It has been a sensory overload. I'm trying to tame that down. I think I'm going to process more of it next week.
Yeah.
After we're done with this weekend. You know, I'm getting text messages and emails and calls. Everyone's, we need this done. This is going on. We're trying to finalize things for the rendezvous. So I think next week is more going to be my look back, but I'm in the moment right now, just kind of sucking it in.
Yeah. Well, let's survive this next weekend, and and hopefully turn out a good show.
Let's survive and kick ass and take
survive. Survival is survival goes hand in hand with kicking ass. So we'll see what we can do. It's truly been a pleasure being in the cab with you across the country, Mr. Lime.
Vice versa. Same right back at you.
Yeah, yeah.
It's been a unique experience. It's always a very unique experience when you're this close to someone for that much time.
Yeah.
It's a very different level of...
Yeah, it's interesting. Yeah. I enjoy it. I've had nothing but good rides across the country with the plethora of cab mates that have been in process. This whole thing started with Zach Scheinman and Peter Warren in 2014, and it set a pretty high bar for what it could look like to drive across North America.
I can only imagine with those two in a vehicle.
It was amazing. It was amazing. By the end of it,
oh man!
By the end of it, we had cowboy wallets, and Peter had a coonskin hat, and I had a lot of really poor statues and sculptures of elk and bears that Little America in Wyoming sold me.
Peter still have that Karen?
I don't know. We'll have
hat?
To ask him.
We'll have to ask.
I've got the picture to commemorate it, though. Maybe we'll have to launch that on social media one of these days.
As a flashback.
With his cowboy wallet and coonskin hat. Yeah.
Yeah, that'd be great.
Well, we'll catch you guys on the other side of the rendezvous. We'll look forward to seeing everybody there who's coming to attend. And Mariah's going to be streaming from the rendezvous. So if you guys don't, if you missed it, you'll be able to check it on Mariah Live. It'll be available to everybody for free. So check that out. Demonstrations and talks and the critique are going to be available for your viewing pleasure. Lime and I are going to wrap up. We're going to knock out the last 8 hours of this drive, hopefully safely. We'll get there one way or another. And we'll see you guys over the weekend, or if not, in the future. Take care.